You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello, I am Soldanela, and this is episode 2 of Notes from a Native Daughter with guest Marlene Ramirez Cancio, and this is a Spanglish podcast.
I'm Soldanela Rivera, and I am the host of Notes from a Native Daughter. This is my second episode, and I am here with my first guest, who also happens to be a dear friend, a sister, you know, that I've known for almost 30 years now. Marlene Ramirez Cancio, a.k.a. Fulana. I forgot to say that before. This is my second take. So Marlene, I think she is, this is how I would sum it up. She's a writer, she's an actor, she's a performer, she's a thinker, she's a cultural worker, advocate, a mother, a friend. She speaks 3 languages and probably even 4, probably even 5, because she's always thinking about these things. So she could probably have this podcast in several languages. Olvídate que esto es Spanglish. But I want to start with in all seriousness, Marlene has a lot to say and share. So we are going to have a conversation with her, or I'm going to have a conversation with her. And my beginning is about forensics. Like when we were back in like middle school and high school, there was this group in at school that, you know, you learned monologues and you practiced them in different categories. And Marlene was a champ. And I want to start there because I don't know how it all began. So. Yeah.
So before I knew you, before we did forensics together, I was in Montessori school, El Colegio Montessori de Puerto Rico. And we had the privilege of working with people like Rosita Marrero, who's a journalist. And at the time, she would write plays for us. And so we had 2 big productions of a play called Nadorcito, and then another one called Brujilla that was at the Teatro Universidad de Puerto Rico, you know, big deal for kids. And it was... costumes, singing,
I went.
The whole thing. You did?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I saw it. I was an audience.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So anyhow, yeah, right? So I'm coming from that. It was a tiny school, super inspiring. Then I get to St. John's, and those first years were rough. You know, I was, like, little, and everybody was, like, big and listening to Madonna. And I was like, menudo, what? You know, I had no idea what was going on. So by the time I hit high school, I think somebody told me about it. It might have, I don't remember who it was. But somebody who had done it from before, maybe Adina Tartak or somebody, say, hey, you should check it out. And I did, and I loved it. And I became the president of it pretty quickly. And so it was great because you got to take 10-minute speeches and monologues from whatever you wanted. You know, it could be there in the different categories. There was drama, there was comedy, there was original, and there was oratory. I always did drama. Blanca, the English teacher, always told me I was in the wrong category, that I should have been doing humor. I don't know how she, why she said that at that time.
So I loved her.
So it started, I haven't seen her forever. So it started that way with that, and then it was great because then it was a team, and then I had to practice with everybody, and, you know, folks doing, you know, comedy like Noah Selsby, you know, doing things from Monty Python, and, you know, folks doing oratory or doing original work. It was great, you know, and then there was also the Spanish version of it called Oratoria, actually. There were 2 teams. So I did both the forensics one in English and the Oratoria in Spanish.
So did I.
Exactly. So that was our theater kick that we were getting there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it, you know.
Yeah, but then you did the Sophie's Choice monologue.
I did the Sophie's Choice monologue.
How did you pick that?
I from the movie. No me acuerdo exactly how, what. I don't remember when I saw it, how I saw it. But it was for my last year. And I remember there was this, I think it started with something like the truth. I don't know what is the truth after all these lies I have told. How do I remember that? I don't know. But so she's confessing to something, but haven't seen the movie since. I don't know. But it was this very moving, you know, thing. And I won. And I beat out like this other, like, you know, super, super, superstar from another school. I was very proud. So I don't remember how it came. I swear to God, you probably have a better memory than me on almost everything having to do with high school. I have the whole chunks of my life that are like deleted, and then I'll remember these like tiny, you know, bursts of like random things. But it was great. I mean, that really started me, the whole elementary school, high school, on, you know, in arts and culture de lleno, you know, like I felt like without that, I don't know if I would be doing what I'm doing now.
And then after that, you went on to Harvard to mm-hmm. study what?
Literature. So, yeah, and I didn't do anything there. Everything was really interesting. The theater, it was more theater there. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was my first experience with, you know, having an accent and, you know, not looking white enough, I guess. I don't know. It was very bizarre. So I did go to auditions, but nothing really, no me llamó la atención. Like, it wasn't the kind of thing that I wanted to do. And so I didn't do any theater at all through undergrad. And it took another few years when I moved to California and during grad school, actually, in San Francisco, outside of grad school, friends of mine, Andrea Tom, Charles Guerrero, etc., they founded a theater called the Red Rocket Theater in 1994, 95. And in 96, I started hanging out with them and they were doing all original work. So I did that and then met some folks there that were with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And then I translated a play into Spanish for the San Francisco Mime Troupe. We toured it in Colombia for a summer. We went to Colombia with it, rather, for a festival. And that was amazing. And then the next year after that, I was in a thing called Latina Theater Lab, also through Andrea and the people that I had met with her. And that was great because, you know, it should have been a clue. Instead of writing a dissertation during the precious fifth year that you have when you have funding, we were artists in residence at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and we were there rehearsing all the time, writing. It was all, again, original material.
And what were you writing about, original
material? So this one was called Last Stop Ranchera, and it was a very, you know, sort of a look at women, all different women coming from their different perspectives, their different backgrounds. You know, there were people that were Chicana, there were people that were Puerto Rican from New York, people that were like Andrea, who's Chilena, Costarricense from Wisconsin, you know, so there was very different perspectives. And so it was just whatever you wanted, you know, so we would do workshops around movement and around song, you know, but I'm not a singer, one of us was, not the rest of us, but it was whatever it was evoked, so it could be anything. And so I wrote something, it was a monologue actually. See, taking it back to forensics, and helped in other things that were of more funny. We did another show called Dragon Lady versus Pocahontas in collaboration with the Asian American theater group and the women of that group, and it was amazing. You know, so it was cross-cultural misunderstandings, you know, stereotyping, but like all, of course, in good love, but already, you know, not a narrative that was coming from, you know, first moments of immigration or anything like that. It was like, you know, from communities that were already established and already had ideas about each other. So it was very organically, let's just say, cross-cultural, intercultural. There was a dialogue happening there. It was hilarious, and it was really, really fun.
When you had evenings where people went to see you?
I had evenings where people went to see us.
Like shows?
Like, they actually showed up. They actually paid money to actually see us. Yeah. So, no, we worked with Shirley Moraga also. She was a dramaturg for Last Stop Ranchera. So it was very, you know, there was a crossover with the guys from Culture Clash who continue to be amazing inspirations. So it was a very privileged moment of being, you know, a Puerto Rican in California. What is that? You know, people, they always think it's Chicano this, Chicano that. So this always explaining about Puerto Riqueña, Puerto Riqueña, Puerto Riqueña, that culminated, because I did all that right before I moved to New York, in this Latina Theater Lab thing, in which there was one Puerto Ricana from New York called Wilma Bonet. She's still out in San Francisco. So it was great. You know, Guillermo Gomez Peña was around in the peripheries of all this. It was a very culturally amazing town to be in for me, who had not experienced really Chicano culture before. I was deeply inspired and influenced by the visual artwork of Yolanda Lopez, and, you know, her, like, I have it out there. The affiche says, "Who is the illegal alien pilgrim?" And it's like this, like, Azteca guy, like, pointing at, like, Uncle Sam, you know. And all of those highly political, you know, the border crossed us type of thing.
Right.
Really started there. Really, my politicization happened between college, I would say, at a first level, feminist wise, and then at a second level, in terms of culture, racism, all that stuff happened. Probably, I could be remembering it wrong, but most intensely in California. Montessori was certainly a political place. You know, there were kids there that were, you know, people like Los Hijos de Silverio Pérez, and people that were definitely in TV and culture and journalists and all that
kind of. Commentators, social commentators. Yeah. Porque Silverio, you know, claro. He's like the top of the line.
So, you know, it was there, you know, in a very independentista environment, very proud of being Puerto Rican, you know, just very, so that came from that and into a very Americanized, you know, completely different environment, not super politicized, you know, at all from my, in my personal experience, what I saw. So going to college, it took, you know, a lot of reading. I remember the first time I read Elenzi Su, you know, and thinking about, you know, women and feminism, and all this, it blew my head open. And so it started there. And then when I went to California, you know, I had never heard of Cesar Chavez and the whole, all of the movimiento and all that stuff. So it, you know, you heard about the other civil rights movement, you know, from the East Coast, but then there was this entire universe of West Coast activity that was, like, just as important and, like, you know, under-recognized, etc. And that was radical. That was great to understand myself as part of a larger Latino culture in the, that was not anymore just, you know, Puerto Rican, but part of a larger Latino culture in the States. In Puerto Rico, we didn't grow up feeling like a minority because we were all Puerto Rican. It was, you know, you're all Puerto Rican. So then that consciousness of what does it mean to be a minority, although, of course, it had started at Harvard, and it was very clear who was from the island and who was from here. I remember arguments early on where the Puerto Ricans from the island wanted to do parties. They wanted to spend the money on parties, and the Puerto Ricans from New York wanted to bring speakers. And they were, like, completely right on, you know. So it was very interesting. The transformation of non-politicized to politicized has been pretty great. And I, you know, you don't have to be raised a certain way in order to arrive at a place of seeing everything through a lens of social justice. So, yeah, so California was essential.
And you were out there how many years?
I was only out there for about 5.5 years. From
really?
94.
It felt so much longer.
No, from 94 to January of 2000. So it was about 5.5 years.
And then you came to the city.
And then I came to New York because I was going to supposedly write my dissertation with Diana Taylor, who's a professor at NYU. My thesis advisor, Mary Louise Pratt, had moved and left Stanford, and so I was sort of stranded. And she connected me with Diana, and Doris Sommer from Harvard also connected me with Diana, and everything was looking like I needed to meet this woman. Since I didn't want to do literature anymore, I wanted to do more theater and performance and write about people doing things, not books, which is what I had focused on before. And I moved here, and Andrea, who I mentioned earlier from Latina Theater Lab, and she was also at Harvard with me. So this woman and I have known each other for forever. She was here doing an MFA in dramatic writing at NYU, and she had a room open all of a sudden and said, "You're not going to believe it, but I have a room open." After I had been here the summer of 99, in January, I was able to actually completely move. So that was fantastic. And I happened to arrive at a moment where Diana Taylor was starting an institute called the Hemispheric Institute of Performance and Politics, which is where I work now. But it was just beginning. She had just done her first course the year before. And in the summer of 2000, she had at that point her first encuentro in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And at the same time, Cristina Ibarra, who had not been in Latina Theater Lab, but she had been, as she always says, she was a fan in the audience and lived in San Francisco as well. We all three of us ended up being in New York at the same time. And then Andrea met Lisandra Ramos, who together formed Fulana as a Latina video and performance collective. Yeah. And the encuentro was definitely a solidifier for that. Even though we didn't do anything as Fulana then, we talked to Guillermo Gomez Peña about it. You know, he certainly is a master of, you know, satire, and we told him our ideas and that. We had done a video called Latino Plastic Cover. That was
I love that one. Latino Plastic Cover.
Latino Plastic Cover. Yeah. It was like a mock cable access commercial. And back in those days, we would circulate it.
Well, let's explain Latino Plastic Cover.
Okay, Latino Plastic Cover.
What is a plastic cover?
Bueno, pues Latino Plastic Cover is...
It's a style. It's a lifestyle
yes,
choice.
Correct.
To protect furniture.
Your muebles, right. So you could cover your sofa in clear plastic so it doesn't get dirty, or your lamps, or your couch, your chair, whatever. Since I have actually heard that might as well have been the Jewish plastic cover, the Black plastic cover.
Oh, really?
Yeah, people, audiences have been like, "Wow, that's, you know, that's in my culture too." But we were coming from ours, so it's Latino plastic cover. So the premise of it was, you know, there was a lot. I mean, now it's much, much, much worse. But even back then, very anti-immigrant rhetoric around crossing the border and illegals and all this stuff. We wondered, I think the initial premise, apart from it being an inside joke, that we wanted to say Latino plastic cover, right? Apart from that, it was about making it more and more absurd. So it's not just you're protecting your furniture, but what else are you trying to protect? What are you so desperate to protect? And so it's protected, your faith. It protected
your Bible.
Exactly. All that kind of stuff. Your kids, your remote control so that they don't take away your telenovelas, you know, etc. It just got more and more absurd until the final thing that it protects, you know, it was like to keep your relatives dry when they cross the border. I mean, it was, that's where we were at, you know, in terms of all of this hysteria. It was a hysteria around that. So we were making fun of it. And it was definitely in and for us, it's Latino Plastic Cover, and it was talking to you, right? So you, señora, if you think dirt is invading your home, right? So it was, the audience was clear. And we circulated it by taking VHS tapes to friends' barbecues and houses. There was no YouTube or anything like that. So we did it that way, by old school. It's, you know,
analog.
Yeah, like rewind,
yeah.
Play.
Yeah.
And that was the start of it. And we continued working. We did several other videos, and even like some live performance stuff, until about 2012, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And once you are a Fulana, you sort of remain one. And so even though we haven't produced videos and work of that kind, we continue teaching satire and parody every year for a program called Emerge NYC that I direct over at Hemi,
mm-hmm.
Where I started working in 2003. And so we continue to, you know, always be thinking about parody, satire, social change, etc.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's so cool.
I love Fulana.
Yeah, we need to bring it back.
You guys,
I mean,
are
somehow.
Awesome. No, it's just witty and profound and well thought out, you know, like tragic comedy at its finest. But you have one of the coolest jobs on the landscape, on the market.
I agree.
yeah, it really is, and it's amazing.
Thanks.
And Marlene serves as Associate Director of Arts and Media at NYU's Hemispheric Institute of Performance and Politics. I had to read that out.
I know. Say that three times fast.
So that I can, you know, keep it straight. No, it's an important job, and I think she can best explain.
Yeah. So as I had mentioned, you know, it had just started. So we were operating out of an old copy room in the performance studies department. It was like a two-person operation with Diana and another student. And I was brought in first as an interviewer for artists when we would go to encuentros, and it was just like a freelance sort of thing. You know, we pay your ticket, we pay your hotel, help us out with interviewing artists. So that's how it started. And then there was an opening in 2003, Serendipity. I had just had a humongous breakup. I had turned 30. It was like this whole thing. And then, boop, there it was. And all of a sudden, I was a project manager. I started.
Okay. Can I hold you? Can you go back? What kind of artists were you interviewing?
You know, a cool artist that I interviewed. I haven't heard from her again. Emma Villanueva, who was this woman from Mexico City who did body art in like a really subversive way. This was 2001. And she would do things like pretend and actually apply for and get jobs as strippers, for example, you know, real, and go to bachelor parties and all that stuff. But then as she was doing the lap dances and all that stuff, she would either slip, you know, or do both. She would slip pamphlets, informational pamphlets about your rights to the women that were working with her, and also talk politics to the men that she was doing lap dances for. So it was this sort of infiltration of these really bizarre universes of where the female body was not expected to do that. You know, they were expecting her to do other things. So she was like an operative, you know, and had these conversations with people, political. And she did other things. She walked in a bikini down like the middle of a humongous avenida in Mexico City as protest, you know, with like things writing on her body. You know, that she was a lot of, you know, body, definitely using the female form on purpose, you know, which gave her access to certain spaces and attention in order to comment on.
That's amazing.
Other things. So, you know, or Diana Rasnovich from Argentina, who was a cartoonist and a playwright. She was one of the women who did Teatro Abierto in Argentina in the early 80s, a place that was burnt down during the dictatorship. So, you know, it was really political. Again, so the politicization from before then got super amplified and magnified by Hemi, and being in a place that the focus of Hemi is bringing together and connecting artists, academics, and activists from throughout the Americas, thus, you know, hemispheric, the Western Hemisphere, that are thinking about and making an intervention into, you know, the political, lo político, not necessarily, you know, electoral politics, although
sure,
maybe,
sure.
But, you know, political life in the Americas.
The philosophy of it in its artistry.
Day to day.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the foundation of, or, you know, what Diana writes about, you know, in terms of performance, she talks about performance being embodied practice. So there is the archive, which we know, all the written, everything, you know, archives. And then there is the repertoire, as she calls it, which is the way that embodied practice and the body also carry knowledge, transmit values, transmit memory through time from body to body to body to body.
And even your own, I mean, that's why you can still remember the opening of the Sophie's Choice monologue.
Exactly, you know, but even food does this, right? So the conquistadores all came to Mexico and they were like, yeah, we're going to delete this whole
thing,
you know, little thing here because they don't have archives or whatever they thought. And we're just going to plop our churches right on top of this little whatever this is, I don't understand. And we're just going to decimate and make it disappear. And that did not work. You know, as we know, even in Puerto Rico, religions got, you know, deities got transformed and morphed and continued.
Old
food, languages.
Underground.
Exactly. And so the embodied practices were not able to be eradicated. And so we really focus on embodied practices at Hemi. So mostly artists that use their body in some way, shape, or form. Although we work with all kinds of artists. But the origin story of it and the biggest focus is performance. And performance also not just limited to the performing arts, but also looking, as Richard Schechner, who's the head, the founder of the Performance Studies Department at NYU, he talks about things being performance, something that is performance, which would be things like plays and all that stuff, but also looking at things as performance. And so it's the as performance. Oh, what happens if we look at, you know, a political demonstration as performance, or the bombing of the Moneda in Chile as, you know, the performance of power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So also looking at things as performance in the everyday life and in, you know, social arenas. So that's sort of the focus of it. And within that, the job evolved, the institute grew, we got many more people. And so I went from project manager to assistant director, now I'm associate director of arts and media. So I focus on everything having to do with arts and media within HEMI. So the archive, which is an amazing project of preserving, historically preserving video documentation of performance practices. So it's like we have like the whole archivo of Teatro La Candelaria in Colombia and Teatro Campesino in California, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of people. Guillermo Huespeña. We have Augusto. We're in the process of processing Augusto Boal's video archive that we got from his family. So it's this historical preservation with a really future view, like 500 years in perpetuity, preserving these things. There's also the encuentros, which are these things that I started participating in. Now we have one in Chile in, oh my God, I leave in like 10 days. And these are about 550 to 750 people, artists, activists, and academics together, thinking about a specific topic. This year, we're going to think about the excéntrico, what's not in the center, you know, lo queer, lo negro, lo migrante, lo todo lo que es periferia, right? All of the peripheral things that are not traditionally in the center of power. And so it's going to be amazing. And we're going to be there for a week doing, you know, there's performances, lectures, roundtable discussions, work group meetings.
So what do you do when you get there? I mean, you can't be at all of the places all at once.
Well, but the cool thing about it actually is that it's not a festival, mm-hmm. and it's an encuentro. So as opposed to it being a festival where everything's at the same time, right? And you go and you have to, these things sort of happen. Of course, there's things that happen simultaneously, like work groups. You're in your work group, I'm in my work group. But in terms of
the run of show is sequential.
It's like sequential. People are supposed to all be there together, have conversations, etc. So a lot of that work starts from before. It's by application. So writing the application form, looking at all, curating the thing, looking at all the proposals. We got 1,300 proposals plus and we could only accept about, you know, 450. So it starts from way before. So by the time we get there, actually, we have this amazing production company called Mil Metros Cuadrados, and they're going to run the show. They're in Santiago de Chile. And so I'm there to have meetings, to support, to make sure that everything's going where it needs to go, but not at the super nitty-gritty, like, you know, where is the hammer that I need to hammer this with, but more like, you know, overview. But it's great. And to see people that, you know, have been in our network now, which is thousands of people, over the course of, this is going to be our 10th encuentro and our 18th year in existence. Is that right? No. We started in 1998. Yeah, 18th year. So it's also like familia, you know, like seeing people and, you know, and also you talked about languages, you know, so being able to speak all, you know, the three languages that I'm most fluent in, which are English, Spanish, and Portuguese. Like, I'm supposed to do that, right? Like, for my job, it's a thing that I have to do. And so that's awesome, you know, being able to be there, work, you know, we translate things for people, but it's awesome for me to be able to go and, like, no matter what the hell language people are speaking, it's pretty awesome. And I've definitely honed it and learned it through HEMI, through my work there, the Portuguese part.
Right.
So, yeah, so it's like, you know, HEMI love all around. And it's, yeah.
So what's your passion project there, or passion projects that are coming out that you're like, oh, right. My God.
Yeah, so something that has happened there is a program that we started in 2008 called Emerge NYC, which is a program for emerging artists in the city. This is in New York, that is thinking about performance and social change together. And so it's become a real passion project. Now we just had the 9th cohort go through. And these are people that are, you know, it draws a lot of queer and people of color and women, you know, to participate, that are doing performance work that is political, that has a message, that they're digging really deep into themselves to figure out, you know, what it is that they want to communicate about. And the more and more that I do that, the more I realize that it's a, you know, changing the world, so to speak, or is something that it needs everybody, right? So sometimes people, oh, why bother? Why perform? If you start getting really NGO-y about it, it's like, well, what impact are you having? You know, like, you know, it's as if it were, right, you know, right. How many gallons of milk did you deliver to that community? So seeing it in a way that my colleague at Stanford called Jeff Chang, he has a great metaphor for this. He talks about social change as a wave, that when it goes into history books, people tend to only look at the crest of the wave, you know, just like this event, but actually there's all of this thing that had to happen before for the wave to form and all of that stuff. And he talks about something that I deeply believe in as well, that culture is the realm where we can change the narrative, right? Is the realm where what we think we believe gets formed, and that political change tends to happen after culture has already changed. So, you know, marriage equality didn't just happen out of nowhere because some legislators thought it up. It had a whole process, cultural, artistic, in terms of, you know, news cycles. But, you know, the arts have a big role in shaping what people have seen. And so knowing that art isn't something that like will directly go and shape culture because I say so, you know, I have this performance and I'm going to shape you in this exact way. There's no guarantees of that, right? Obviously. But what I can do, or what we can do as artists, is fill those spaces in the minds of people in their experience, which is how people filter the next thing that they're going to see. So you see a performance, I can't guarantee what you're going to get out of it, but I can probably guarantee that you're going to filter that performance through things that you have seen before, that you have thought about before, that you have been presented with before, your own life experience. So the theorist called Rancière talks about that. So the combination of, this is the awesome thing also about working with academics, artists, and activists, that my own sort of beliefs get shaped by arenas that are multiple.
Well, that's the way it should be. I mean, it's an amalgam of understandings.
Yeah.
That represent, I think, the deepness of the hemispheric expression.
Yep. And so the passion project there is being able to get all of that, all of those thoughts and that on those practices. Not, we don't just change the narrative. We do change the narrative in culture, but we also change the practices, right? Going back to the repertoire, you know, we change the practices. And so having a group of 18 people coming together every year, and I get to follow their journeys through that and then beyond, staying connected, that's been incredible. And likewise, at the Encuentros, it's the same thing, you know, this community that gets formed through time. And my favorite part of Encuentros tend to be the social spaces, like, for example, Trasnocheo, which is the late night cabaret. There's performance there, but there's also beer and there's also eating. And it's a fun time when a lot of actual thinking gets done, you know, because in these conferences, you know, social space is crucial for things actually getting done and being like absorbed into the body after a long day of lectures and roundtables and other things. So again, sort of this intersection between the social, the love, the friendship, the caring deeply about people and nourishing them and like caring like what you felt and what you thought and how did that inform your whole thing, no matter if you're a famous artist, or if you're a super emerging artist, or if you're not even going to be an artist at all, you could go on and be whatever, but you're still going to be informed by your experiences in thinking about and going through processes like Emerge NYC, which is, you know, or the Encuentro, of course, but Emerge NYC is really intense because it lasts 3.5 months or 3 months. So passion projects and at work, I would say that, and then, but they're all sort of passion projects. What's not to be passionate about in terms of preserving historically the, you know, the archives of amazing people like Augusto Boal, right? So I think I'm lucky. When you said earlier that I have a really great job, I really agree because I feel super spoiled. So all of it is great. We're now going to start focusing on migration, and I'm excited to learn more about the processes now of like the intense, you know, flows and violence and awfulness that's happening, just and how artists make an intervention within that. I recently wrote a short piece, super short piece, for a journal called Asterix, I think. It was in English and it was using humor So it wasn't the same type of project. And I really enjoyed that. So that could be another possibility. But yeah, it's the personal writing. It's the type of thing that, that I wish that I had more of a discipline for.
No, you have it. I just think you have a lot on your plate. So it might just be like, for now, is there. But I think you'll get to it.
Yeah. I mean, I also engage in limpiastination, you know, or cyber limpiastination, which is what the piece in Asterix was about. It's, you know, procrastination, right? So sometimes you clean.
Oh, my God. I'm an expert. O sea, yo.
Limpiastination, right?
Me meto al top like there's no tomorrow.
Right. And so then there's cyber limpiastination, which is like you're just cleaning up your digital life because you organized me iTunes and I'm going to clean up my photo album and now with a baby.
My email inbox.
Right. Oh, yeah. Email inbox, you know. So there's a lot of like things that I quote unquote need to do that are so important, you know, and it's all instead of getting to the thing that I actually need to get done. So there's those struggles, right, of what it is. Where is that going to go? I'm 42. I'm turning 43 this month. You know, really? When? You know, there's a little 5-year-old, probably also a 23-year-old in me going, mija, dame algo, you know. I founded a literary magazine at Harvard. I that is defunct. It was short-lived. But still, we did that, you know, with my friend Tito Busso. There was the lyrical aspect of it, you know. There was a thing there my whole life that has been not taken seriously. So if you're listening and you're a writer and you're not taking yourself seriously, give me a bleeping break because it's a mistake. So I need to figure that out. But I'm very lucky in my other aspects of life, career-wise, family-wise. I have a beautiful baby.
It's a journey.
But it's a journey. So, it's like, am I going to be 60 and then be like, okay, I think
well,
I can write now.
maybe, yeah. Maybe, right. Maybe, yeah. You have to be okay with that.
I know. I'm trying.
Because you're not a procrastinator. It's not like you're a person that doesn't, you know, you're very busy. You have a lot of responsibilities.
I'm a busy procrastinator.
No, I think you could be more noble with yourself. I don't think you'll leave it till the day before you die.
I hope not. My initial thesis advisor at Stanford gave me such great advice in 2004 when I finally decided that I wasn't going to write my dissertation. It had nada que ver. At that point, you know, nothing to do with what I wanted to do. My whole committee had fallen apart. They didn't get tenure. I would have had to start over again. Really, I wasn't about doing the PhD and the academic life in that way, where people are so hardcore, they're move anywhere to just do their research and their writing. I knew that that wasn't for me. And so, but I got there in part through this, what she told me at a party once. She said, you know, you need to give up expired notions of yourself and become the person you're actually in the process of becoming.
Right.
Yes. And so that's when I embraced, you know, fully Hemi. That was my first year there. And it's like, yeah, I like this. I like having a job where I, you know, I'm communicating with people and I'm, you know, fomentando the arts and culture and blah, 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 blah. Let me do this. And it's been great. And I'm really glad I did it. And then I got the MFA, which also made her cry when she found out that I finally got an MFA. So it's a good, made her cry in a good way. I was smiling, crying.
Yeah, I got
it. But anyway, so I have to become the person I'm in the process of becoming, but I wonder when the process of becoming a writer that gives herself the time and space to do that will arrive. I'm waiting for you. That's what I want to know.
Okay. Yeah. You might not get an answer.
Yeah, but exactly. But it's there.
You're already a writer. You're already a writer. You just haven't had time to sit.
I have not.
In the past couple of years.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll see. I am hard on myself. So I hear I haven't had time, and I can tell you all the times that I've been watching Netflix where I could have been having the time. But, you know, it's a thing. I don't know. I can't explain it, but it's a desire, apart from everything else that still burns.
I'm so glad.
There's a future.
She has this girl, you see what I'm saying? She's got she's got fire. I admire you. And
thank
I think
you.
It's
I
it's great
you.
That you do all these things. We're gonna wrap it up.
Okay.
I thank you for your time.
Of course, thank you.
I think that it's interesting. Well, actually I have one more question.
Yeah.
What do you think is the the matter, like from what you see of all these artists that are there, what do you think they all have in common? What breaks your heart, like when you see a riveting performance? That's another question.
So the artists that I happen to work with and see the most, what they all do very much have in common is a strong burning desire and drive to change things that make them angry right now. What is pissing you off right now in the world? And they're working to change those things. So be it folks that are trans and are really working to change perceptions and narratives and practices around their life, or whether it be folks that are, you know, really thinking about structural racism and police brutality, or people that are in different countries thinking about things in their own. You know, there's people that are thinking about student debt. There's people that are thinking about AIDS. There are people all. So it's always something about the world, the shape it is in now, and especially if it affects their lives and how to work from your art to change it. So, you know, sometimes that is heartbreaking. Sometimes you see performances and they're profound and heartbreaking. And sometimes they're incredibly filled with hope. And sometimes I find that humor, satire, parody is a great way to approach a lot of those really, really hard issues and really serious issues. And you see that, you know, throughout, you know. And it's one of my favorite things is to see humor from different countries, different, even if I don't get what they're exactly talking about. You get the general, if you don't get the specifics about who the alcalde of such and such town is, you get the general thing and the play on words and all that stuff. So it's inspiring to be around a lot of artists, activists and academics, everything that are working to do that. And by the way, I love this, el adiós Latino, where you're like, okay, bueno, pues nos vemos, and then you stand at the door, and it's like, bueno, espérate, una cosita más.
Exacto, like what I just did.
Yeah, like, I have my coat on, we're about to go, you know, Andrea and her husband Eddie always joke about that, you know, they want to write a whole play. It's like the Latino goodbye, just the whole play, an hour and a half, will just be like them at the door, the kids with the like abrigos, you know, sweating, sí, you know, the moms sí. just continuing to talk, sí. pero espérate, que, you know, mm-hmm. and, the kid, and this is the kids from the kids' perspective, just like sweating in their little.
Yeah, I see it.
Waiting for the parents to finally say goodbye.
I see it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank yeah. you.
No, mama, thank you, por favor.
Life, honor, and culture. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to Notes from a Native Daughter. Follow us or listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. Thank you.